You are now listening to The Griot's Black Podcast Network, Black Culture Amplified.
Hey, Griot fam. We know you love The Griot Black Podcast Network and wouldn't want to miss out on any new episodes. So you'll want to hear this. A recent update by Apple might have paused your podcast feed. This means our new episodes aren't being downloaded to your phone. But there's a quick fix. For our Apple listeners, here's what you do. Open Apple Podcasts and search for the Griot Black Podcast Network or the name of your favorite Griot pod. Then, go to our show page and look at the top right corner. If you see a pause button there, simply tap it to continue seeing episodes in your feed. If you see a download button, go to settings and set it to automatically download episodes. If you see a plus button, tap it to follow the show. There you have it. That's it. Now you won't miss out on any new episodes of your favorite shows on the Griot Black Podcast Network.
What's going on, everybody? Welcome to Dear Culture, the podcast for, by, and about the culture here at the Griot Black Podcast Network. I'm your host, Panama Jackson, and today we're going to have a conversation that's probably going to span many different facets of hip-hop culture, what the culture means in 2024, and we are joined by rapper, activist, teacher in the sense of KRS-One, the way KRS-One liked to make hip-hop about teaching and providing, educator, fellow, opinionated in a way that's about upliftment, spiritual brother. You know him, I know him. We are joined today by D1. How you doing today, brother?
Thank you for the introduction, family. I'm doing great. I'm ready to get into this convo. I know it's gonna be powerful.
Yeah, I gotta be honest. I was looking forward to having this conversation with you. So I'm one of those people who follows your career, know who you are, have the albums, listen to the music. I also owe Sally Mae money so I remember those days. I remember Sally Mae back in the buzz that got online. But guess what I did? I finished paying Sally Mae back. Mae back. I finished paying Sally Mae back. Mae back. And I keep up with all of the conversations that are happening that you've been having quite frequently with, seems like everybody, right? About accountability in hip hop. Calling out artists with love, with genuinely and sincerely asking for people who have these huge platforms to use them, not in a negative light, but positively. So let me start by asking you this. Are you on an island by yourself? Like, do you feel like you're just sitting on an island where you're trying to address an ill that seems to have always been present in hip hop, but seems to be more prevalent in many ways? I don't know if it's because more people have access to creating art, and because we view hip hop as a way of making money, and this is what makes money, people are doing this. Is it a lonely battle you feel like you're fighting?
Is it a lonely battle? I definitely feel like I'm outnumbered. So numerically, There are more people who I would say are using their mainstream spotlight to unfortunately glorify a bunch of negativity. But although I feel outnumbered in the human sense, I have God on my side. So I don't feel outnumbered in the sense of me fighting a battle that won't be victorious. But every person whose mind I can help to enlighten or change or uplift their mentality for how they want to use their art and how they even want to consume this amazing art form that we call hip hop, that's a win right there. So I measure my wins differently. I'm not in a race to be like, so who streamed more first week out of me and this artist? Like that's child's play. Right. You know, we. So of course it's an uphill battle, but also my first name is David. So I've been battling Goliaths my whole life, brother. And this is nothing new to me. That's why I'm not scared. That's why I'm not backing down. And that's why I know at the end of the day that what I'm doing is going to be victorious, because waking up an entire generation of creators and consumers is something that's going to reverberate throughout society for decades and decades to come. So, you know, why not do it now during my lifetime?
So I've long had this, like, for instance, I don't write about white people anymore. I don't write about the white gays. I stopped writing about the struggle in the same way that I used to, because I noticed, like, for one, it took a lot out of me, right? Like, I stopped writing about the things that were painful, and I focus on celebrating Black culture. But I also noticed that there's really not a big marketplace for Black joy. Like, we kind of love Black joy and upliftment in small pieces, but as a way of dealing with and interacting with culture, I don't know that we love it as much as I wish that we did. So when you speak positivity and attempting to bring positive imagery, ideas, and thoughts into a culture that, you know, and I'm a hip hop head, like I've said, and I hate to say this, but nihilism, like the violent sex, drugs, murder, like mayhem is just a part of it to some degree. It's not the only messaging, but it's a lot of what tends to be consumed heavily. Like, do you think pushing the positive imagery is making a difference? Like, do you see the ripple?
Oh, man, what? Oh, absolutely, bro. Like, man, I'm here at Tufts University right now where I'm a professor and I teach a course on the intersection of hip-hop and social change. You know, this is a byproduct. This is part of the ripple. Every day when I walk into my classroom and I see these students whose mentality towards how they consume and create hip-hop is being constantly challenged and is being nurtured with real-life examples of me showing what hip-hop originated as, what hip-hop became because of commercial pressure, you know, from the industry by and large. And for me to see 18 to 21-year-old students in here and they're like thinking different about things. And the ones who want to be artists, they're thinking different about the impact that their music is really having on society at large. Yeah, I see the ripple, man. And I see the ripple because what y'all don't see are the conversations that I'm having behind closed doors and behind the scenes with a lot of these artists. Y'all don't see me and Styles P talking. You know, y'all don't see me and various artists who you'll be surprised. You'll be surprised certain artists who you're like, oh, I know this person is opposed to D and what D is saying. And you'll be surprised how behind the scenes a lot of people are like, brother, I admire your courage. And you saying, well, y'all not seeing unless I post an Instagram clip, me and DMC, you know what I'm saying? From Run DMC talking and him saying, yep. You saying everything that needs to be said that a lot of other people are afraid to say.
And that's what I say is the difference between glorification, narration, and education.
And especially if you ain't in that life no more.
You know, y'all not seeing that stuff. So I see the ripple, but reaching the artists is only one part of the movement. Y'all not seeing the Platinum Pledge, which I launched on January 1st of this year, to where the Platinum Pledge is people leading a transformation involving newly unified mindsets. That's the acronym for Platinum. Okay. The Platinum Pledge is a public vow that I have challenged people to take, saying, yo, I vow not to create, support, or promote music that's glorifying, keyword, glorifying, murder, drug dealing and drug use, disrespecting women, and sexual irresponsibility, you heard me? And me putting that out there, y'all not seeing the thousands and thousands and thousands and thousands of people who have signed that already. And I just did a soft launch this month. Now when I really kick it up, now when this Grill interview drop, and now when, you know, when we really go into the phase of pushing this, and people are like, oh my goodness, there's strength in numbers. Like, they're not just, like you said, just a little niche of people who enjoy Black joy, but it's like, whoa, people are ready to step up to the plate and publicly say, yeah, like the lines have been drawn and we are on this side of the line that wants to root for creating and consuming content that easily elicits Black joy. So the ripple is definitely happening. Now you're seeing what we haven't seen in hip hop, which is that difficult conversations lead to solving difficult problems. But all too often, we have bad communication skills in the culture to where it's like, oh, you opposed me publicly or whatever. We beefing, we ops. And I'm not finna, man, my life is too blessed to be wanting to beef with another Black man. Like, it's not beef. It's not coming from a place of beef at all. And if anything, it's the fans. That's where we're gonna see the ripple effect because there's more fans than there are artists. So I just want fans to get to the point to where they can say, you know what, I'm attached to these artists because I enjoy their craft and everything, but I'm not unhealthily attached to the point where I'm saying yes to and I'm supporting stuff that in any other context, I would be totally opposed to what this messaging is. But just because it's coming from this artist who I am attached to, you know, because I grew up on this artist, just because of that, I'm okay with this. I'm just wanting fans to be like, oh, okay, we can think for ourselves.
So I actually wouldn't be surprised to hear that artists that you're speaking with agree with like the messaging and everything, because look, so I grew up in the 90s. I actually wrote this article a couple years ago that I went back to read in preparation for this about Dr. Dre's The Chronic being like one of my favorite albums of all time that I can't listen to anymore, right? Like I can't listen to that because it's so ridiculous, the amount of like rape, murder, mayhem and all this stuff in it. Like it's almost a parody. And I'm listening to it and I understand why I enjoyed it. The beats were amazing. Like everybody's rapping is amazing. Like it's as a body of work, it's very well executed and well done. But the messaging is such that as a grown man, I struggle to truly appreciate what some of that stuff is. And I imagine as especially a lot of artists, as you grow as a human being, you have children, like you look at life differently. You start to see the way that some of these things get released. And you're like, you know, that's not where I'm at. So I wouldn't be surprised, actually, like you mentioned Styles P, like Styles P on a health thing, right? Like these people who have elevated in terms of like their humanity and wanting to live a long time, like not the way that we view ourselves in the hood. We're getting to like 25. Once you get to a point, it's like, wait, I can make it to 75 or 80. Now I got to approach life differently, right? Like I got to think about things differently. And that includes lifestyle changes of art and music and all of that stuff. So I'm not surprised by that. I'm not even surprised, and you know, I see the public pushback that you get from, you know, I'm not going to name everybody, but you know, the Jim Jones and all this stuff, and I believe that a conversation with these people behind closed doors would definitely be, they can't not understand where you're coming from. Like, everybody, like, when you're on the side of right, especially in terms of the imagery that we put out into the community, forget the white gaze, but just in terms of how we view ourselves and what we want to consume as people, like, I can't imagine that anybody would see that as not right or negative or anything like that. I hate, and I know you do, the whole, it's just entertainment. I hate that line of reasoning and logic, and I know you do too, you have to. So why do you think we keep falling on it's just entertainment, sir, and we gotta know better than that?
Well, some artists feel like you're impacting their bag and their income. If you call them out and if you challenge what it is that they are choosing to glorify with their platform.
D2.
What do you say?
look. You look like you got drafted for D4 basketball, right?
These dudes.
But what about what he said, though? Is it any credence to what he said about
that? I don't care about what he said. Okay. That boy don't know me. I miss me with the rhetoric about what I do in my music. I get money off my music. Don't tell me how to make my dollars.
So at that point, it becomes a scarcity thing to where many times artists feel as if I haven't proven that I can make money glorifying anything else other than what I've been doing for the past 20 years in my music. So that can become a thing to where, you know, people feel they feel attacked and they maybe feel like it's an indictment on their character. That's the other thing. Artists can feel as if you're making it seem like I'm a bad person, like I'm not doing all this stuff that I'm doing for the community and for my friends and for my family. And my thing is like, brother, sister, because it's the women too. So that's not, brother, sister, it is not an indictment on your character. Now, if you want to publicly come out and say, yep, this is what I want. I want to kill my fellow black men and women. I want our babies to be miseducated. I want to sell dope to the community. You know, I want all this stuff to happen. I want the women to be disrespected. If you want to say that, then that'll be a different conversation that'll elicit a different response from me. But I don't think deep down that that's what you want. And I don't think that that's who you are. So I study this stuff from a psychological perspective to where I know that it's pressure from the industry to make you feel as if you have to live up to this persona that has been created and this persona that's been incentivized year after year after year by an industry and by a fan base who says, well, we're going to pay this person handsomely and reward them with fame and even legendary status for glorifying murder, drug dealing, disrespecting women, and all of the above. And that right there, that's the issue. That's the problem, is I'm simply saying, now we can do better than that. We absolutely can. And, you know, you can become a prisoner to your persona when your persona has produced paper and you know, just so many financial incentives for you over time. But I don't want us to become a prisoner to our persona. I want us to fully be liberated and to be able to unify in a way that makes the industry have to shift, because the desires of creators have shifted and the consumption habits of consumers have shifted. So that's my goal. Some people, Panama, they say, why are you not calling out the industry? Why you don't call out this person and this label and this label and da-da-da? Man, at the end of the day, these people are nothing but capitalists. They simply are following the money. So if I can empower the people that I can touch, which are these artists, you see, I'm able to get responses from artists and fans. I mean, I got hundreds of thousands of followers on every platform, so I can reach fans on a daily basis. That's who I want to empower, because that's who I know, like, we have the ability to truly shift the industry. The industry, the commissioners, I call them, they're going to shift after the consumers and the creators shift.
Time for a quick break. Stay with us. I'm Torre. Join us for crazy true stories about stars who I really hung out with, like Snoop, Jay-Z, Prince, Kanye, and the time I got kidnapped by Suge Knight. Don't miss my animated series, Star Stories with Torre, from the Griot Black Podcast Network. And we're back.
Chance the Rapper releases The Big Day, which is an amazing record about kind of like his wedding. And it's an album about positive imagery for the most part, you know, and people panned that thing. Like, his fans were like, this is, what is this nonsense, right? A lot of times when artists do move in this direction, they do, you do sacrifice some of that fandom, which ultimately sacrifices part of your bag. Like, what is that conversation like with artists who do, I mean, listen, you're an artist, you make money through music, in other ventures, but you know, you're a rapper. So when people combat that, like, I'm trying to make my money, you're trying to take food out of my baby's mouth. If I change up how I do things, like, what is the response to that for people? Because it is true. Yeah. I mean, as much as we might think that it shouldn't be the case, it is true. Like,
yeah,
this stuff does sell, unfortunately, and the
It does sell.
I hate to say that.
It's not true. It's actually not true. We have to stop fooling ourselves to think that. Two of the richest rappers walking this earth are J. Cole and Kendrick Lamar. And everyone would agree that their catalog, I'm sitting here looking on my phone as we're talking. Kendrick Lamar has now passed 35 million equivalent album sales in his career. If I was to look up J. Cole's overall album sales, we all know J. Cole for going triple platinum with no features and you know, just right. always doing these numbers that can't be denied, can't be debated. When you talk about Chance, let's keep in mind that having a positive or an empowering message in your music still is not an excuse for saying it doesn't have to connect creatively with your audience, you know? So if The Big Day, his album, just didn't connect creatively with his audience, then let's call it what it is. But if Coloring Book did connect much more with his audience, then we just have to say, yo, it's the same way the Chronic connected in a way that maybe other projects from Dre didn't connect. It's the same way that Doggy Style may have connected in a way that Snoop's other projects didn't connect. So
right. It's
the same way that growing up in New Orleans, that the Carter One from Lil Wayne connected in a way that 500 Degrees, his album right before that, didn't connect, you know, with his audience.
Right.
That's same subject matter on all of these albums that I'm referring to. But I don't want us to minimize it to, because I've heard it all at this point.
It's not just the positivity. Sometimes the art just ain't arting in the way that people want to hear. That's fine.
Because I've heard it. I've heard the, it's only entertainment argument. I've heard the, well, If I rap about something different, people not going to want to, you know, support that and not going to want to, you know, hear that type of argument. And none of that stuff is true. Like, it's simply just, it's not true. We got to think about the overall impact. Do you know how many people have gone on record and said that they were influenced to sell dope because of Young Jeezy's first album? Look, I'm telling you, man. If you get jammed up, don't mention my name. Forgive me, Lord. I know I ain't living right. Gotta feed the block. Stop appetite. Do you know how many people, a dude in my class, bro, that I'm about to go teach in, who did 10 years in prison and is out now and is pursuing a degree here at Tufts University, literally said that to my whole class, bro. Like, yo, I was totally influenced to sell dope.
Because of Jeezy?
He said Jeezy's early music was the soundtrack to him and his boys in the hood beginning to sell dope. Yes. Absolutely.
Now, but I'm one of the people that always struggles with that part too. Like I understand the argument and I don't necessarily disagree with it. Like if this music is out here, like it's hard not to be influenced by that, right? Like I do fully believe that. I listen to, actually, in that same article where I talk about Dr. Dre's A Chronic, I do talk about the fact that thank God I had parents who could guide me properly. Because if not, I'd be calling every woman I know a bitch, like, nonstop, right? That would just be if the music is what I was using and that was the only influence I had, who knows my mentality. So I'm one of the people that definitely believes that type of stuff. But it's crazy to hear people actually, like if it wasn't Jeezy, they would have found something else. Like, it's, if you're going to sell drugs, you're going to sell drugs. I can't imagine that you're only going to enter that because of Jeezy. The terrible things, decisions I've made do have soundtracks. And it is 99% of the time the hip-hop I was listening to at the time. So it is kind of,
bro,
I do buy that line of thinking.
We have to stop acting like it's just entertainment. It is literally something to where,
right.
I can't name you a sermon from a pastor 20 years ago. If you gave me $1 trillion, I can't name you a sermon that I personally heard 20 years ago. I can't recall a lecture from a teacher in school from 20 years ago. But I can rap word for word lyrics to songs that I heard 20 years ago, man, because of how that sits with you in your mental and in your brain. And if you have all of this information that gets stored up here for so long, this stuff, depending on the other factors present in your life, parental influences, because of course, parents should have the main influence on you and other things that you're going through socially and emotionally, the music can become a soundtrack. Now you have these anomalies, and the anomalies are the people who say, well, I listened to music that was glorifying Buku murder, you heard me? But that music, all it did was motivate me to run 5 miles every day when I was training for my track meets and for the track team. That music about glorifying murder, that was simply my soundtrack to being in the weight room during football season. You have those anomalies, but you have those other people who is like, no, that was the soundtrack to me being in the hood and listening, like these dudes describing my reality. So they also giving me a how-to on how to deal with certain real situations. And like, we can't act like it's not both. There's some people who can take one thing. There's somebody who could say, yo, I watched D1 and Panama and the Griots interview right now. And that was the soundtrack to me cooking up a great meal, some gumbo. You heard me? Like that. That's what and the next person is like, how you saying that was the soundtrack to you making some good gumbo? For me, that was the soundtrack to me understanding the implications of the messages inside of hip-hop music. Some people are taking more literally, and some people are be like,
right.
Well, I consumed the same content, but it had a whole different impact on me. So we have to acknowledge that both happens. But more often than not, Panama, who are the people who interpret this music more literally? It's the people whose lifestyle this music is describing and speaking for, and that's our people. That's Black people. 99% of the time, the person who does get more impacted by it is the person who is already disadvantaged socially, economically, parental structure, more messed up, you know, growing up in these conditions that's being described in the music, not the suburban white kid who is just right. Like, yo, this is just entertainment, and me and my friends be in the car, and we be vibing.
Yeah.
And we just be vibing out because it is just entertainment for some of them. But when we get to the point where we acting like it's just entertainment for us and for our people, man, get out of here. And I'm not talking to you when I say, man, get out of here. I'm just saying when people try to
I understand completely.
I can just see all these fans. Yeah.
Who do you listen to typically, like right now? So I saw an interview where you were talking about your favorite MCs. Like people, you know, they love to ask people their top five. And I saw that you pretty much was like, I don't have a top five like I used to. Nas, yeah. I saw you mention Nas is still like your favorite MC and, or and has Lupe been your Fiasco. Favorite rapper. And Lupe, you mentioned Nas and Lupe.
I named Nas and Lupe. I know where we're going. So that was the first interview. Shout out to the Art of Dialogue. That was the first interview where I got asked that question. And
really,
during the interview, I had to catch myself because I was like, D, you can't be what it is that you are speaking up against at this point, which is, like, I'm an artist. I got 11 albums out. Like, I'm a full-fledged artist, like, through and through. But I'm also a consumer. And with that being said, I can't be a consumer who is so tied to the music that I grew up on for nostalgic reasons that,
right.
that I sit here and I say, well, I'm going to ignore the reality of the messaging inside of that music just because I got my list of my top five that I always lean on, you know? And in that interview, I caught myself and I was like, brother, I was like, I don't even know if I got a top five that I could just name right now. And I was like, I feel comfortable naming Nas. I feel comfortable naming Lupe. But the other artists who I normally would say on my top five, and it's well-documented, different people that I would name, I'm like, at this point, this has probably been a turning of the corner for me to where I don't want to be so attached to these artists and to certain music just because I grew up on it that I'm unwilling to say, hey, I need to grow past the point of saying that like that music holds this much weight in my life. So I was going to name other artists, but I stopped, you know? And yeah.
Well, so that's why I asked who you listening to. Like who does D1 listen to now that fits, that doesn't present a moral dilemma or anything when like listening to the artists?
Sure, I'm listening to the Dramatics. I'm listening to the Spinners. I'm listening to Bill Withers. You hear me? I'm listening to the OJs. I'm listening to my man Durando. I'm listening to Earth, Wind & Fire, Marvin Gaye. Like, man, that soul music from the 70s really like puts me in a space that I really enjoy being in, you know, mentally and emotionally. You know what it is, brother? I'm able to listen to certain songs from artists to where I've gotten to where I'm a pro at saying, well, when it comes to Kanye, like that, them first three albums from Kanye, oh yeah, man. Like sign me up all day for College Dropout, Late Registration, Graduation. Sign me up for that. Then when I want to listen to a Jada Kiss, there's certain songs that I could listen to from a Jada Kiss, a Why, you know what I'm saying? There's certain songs, to where I can hear people, DMX, who is always in my top five. But at this point, it's like, I can say Slipping, you know what I'm saying?
Right.
For sure. You know, when I was talking to Styles the other day, and I told him, I'm like, man, your song, Green Piece of Paper, to where you are dissecting your relationship with money on this song. And, like, this is something that for a long time has been something where I'm like, ooh, like, I like what he did there. Live my whole life for a green piece of paper. Did some tripe shit for a green piece of paper. Did some hype shit for a green piece of paper. But for me to just give a blanket statement that like, hey, this artist in totality is like top five, that implies I'm embracing all or almost all of everything they do. And with that, I just got two right now, man. And I gotta think harder, you hear me?
Yeah, so I'm surprised it was the first time you've been asked that question because it seems like the natural question you would ask any MC, especially when it's prolific as yourself, who clearly like is a lyricist at heart, who is interested in the art of writing bars and all of that. Like it's interesting. All right, we're gonna take a real quick break here. We come back. I want to talk more. We're gonna keep having this conversation, and I really want to talk about what's happening, what you're doing at Tufts, and your time as a fellow at Harvard. So stay tuned right here on Dear Culture.
Yo, come look at what Michael Harriet just posted.
Black Twitter, come get your mans.
It's his podcast episodes for me.
I was today years old when I found out Michael Harriet had a podcast. Subscribed.
I'm world-famous white peepologist Michael Harriet, and this is The Griot Daily.
That's right, the Black Twitter King has a podcast, The Griot Daily with Michael Harriet, every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday on the Griot Black Podcast Network and accessible wherever you find your favorite podcasts.
And we're back.
Hola, hola, people need motivation. My city, the murder capital of the nation. You know, in them trenches, it's survival of the fittest. I pray we get the confidence to value our existence.
All right, we're back here on Dear Culture, and I'm here with D1. We're talking effectively the state of hip-hop and just talking about accountability in hip-hop, which is, for me, for my generation, you know, folks who grew up on 90s hip-hop, as I've grown as a human, as a parent, as all this stuff, it all comes into play because I have these conversations. I have a 15-year-old daughter, and I'm always trying to figure out when to introduce her to some of the music that I loved. And then I listen to it, I'm like, I don't even think I want you to hear this. Which then makes me think about my own musical, like, education and journey and all that stuff. It's been very interesting as a parent of children and thinking about the music that I've loved that has effectively been a part of raising me. I gotta ask about the Sexy Red conversation. I hate to do this because I hate scapegoating people. Like, I really hated when Soulja Boy got basically blamed for killing hip hop, and like, I hate when we do that. We pick an artist and turn them into like the poster child for the thing that is wrong. But you know, like you know, you teach at Tufts. I teach at Howard, and we have a lot of conversation. I teach a class on opinion writing at Howard, and so that constantly conversations about hip hop artists, and especially, there's a lot of women in my class, so of course the Sexy Red. We always talk about the Meg and Nicki Minaj, of course, dominated my class yesterday, and Sexy Red always comes up as a point of note because it's like there's two schools of thought there, right? There's this woman has full agency and is authentically being herself and creating the music that she wants, and then there's the other side of it is like, why is this the music that you want to put out there? What are you putting out there? What is this imagery that you're putting out there? Does this elevate the community in any way, shape, or form? So when you see artists like Sexy Red that are so polarizing, like, and I imagine because of the class that you teach on hip hop and social change, which I really want to talk about, like, how do you have those conversations?
I still think that it's a conversation where we have to acknowledge you are not like this 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. You are choosing what aspect of you to encapsulate, make music about, and then push out there and continue to pull from that same bag and be like, let's pull another song from that same bag, that same micro aspect of who I am, and just continue to put that out there. It's still just decisions, but you got to look at young men and young women with a different lens than you look at the elders, you know, and the OGs inside the industry. So when you are young and you're in your teens or your early 20s, you're still trying to find yourself oftentimes, and you can easily be manipulated and do something strange for a little piece of change. And when it's a big old piece of change that's being dangled in front of you, and you sitting here like, wait, this all I got to do is tap into this side of who I am, because this is authentically me to a certain degree, and just keep making music from that standpoint. That right there is what is what we have to guard against in our community. But you guard against that by the elders being like, hey, we're going to cover you, and we're going to make sure that this industry can't come in and try to take advantage of you. But we don't have enough good OGs. We have DGs. And that's disappointing grown-ups. That's what we got oftentimes in the culture. You feel me? And because of that, you got these artists who we want to put the weight of the world on their shoulders. And I mean, to whom much is given, much is required, for sure. So I do pray that a Sexy Red can just wake up, and that queen, that sister can see, like, come on, sweetie. Like, they using you, boo. Like, I promise you in 10, 15 years, you're going to look back. And you're gonna be like, oh, them people really only cared about how much money I could make for them by showcasing a side of me that ultimately will be detrimental to my own community. Like once your brain fully, you know, develops and you're able to see that for what it is, you'll look back and you may not have as much influence as you have now. Or you have to think, whose life have you influenced in potentially a negative way that you can't, you know, you can't touch that person again now because that was years ago that they were listening to you and tuned into you. So that's all. We just trying to break the cycle. And I think with these artists, you look at somebody like a Drake, you know, at this point, I think that we've heard everybody from, it's interesting because I think about my man, Joe Budden, and shout out to Joe Budden. I got to say that as a disclaimer, because he and I have had some back and forths, you know, so.
It's clout chasing. Leave my name and likeness out of your internet shenanigans.
This is not coming from a bad place at all. This is coming from a place of, it's interesting because you can tell that Joe Budden is an intellectual dude when it comes to how he approaches hip hop. He's been in the industry. He can speak to it from the commercial aspect to being on the creative side. But he even looked at Drake, I think on Drake's last album, as being a person who is like, hey man, you need to step your content up. Like you do. Like you just, you're of age now to where you need to step your content up. You need to stop approaching these young women and just young women who you wanting to get involved with and entangled with and all that stuff. But also content-wise, we just need more from you. It's interesting that like people tend to feel that way about artists who they know you can do better and you have more to you than what you're choosing to put out there. At a certain point, people feel like you should have turned the corner. I don't think that I am alone in thinking that. And here's the last thing I'm going to say on this topic, because I'm a college professor at this point. You are as well. You teach college. Yo, if your students, brother, at Howard University are saying, man, look, it's going down this weekend. We're going to be partying in this person's apartment. We having a house party. That thing going to be lit. That thing going to be turned up. And you got a bunch of 18 and 19-year-olds saying that. And if you, the father of a 15-year-old, if you like, man, let me know what time. Drop that low. You heard me? I'm there. Like, I'm pulling up. Like, that's going to be an awkward pause moment. And it's just going to be like, hold on, man. Like you in a different, you know, you around us, but you not, like, you not one of us. We're expecting more from you. Come on, man. You not us. So that is how we need to view hip-hop when it comes to the OGs or the veterans in hip hop. Because now when we talk about a sexy red, it won't have to be something to where you counting on one person to have the courage to speak what everybody knows. It's like, come on, man. Like, yo, we could do better than this. But it hits different when you have a whole bunch of people in the community that are saying that, as opposed to a couple outliers and they want to call you a hater or they want to call you, yeah, like, oh, you're just hating on this person, man. Miss me with that.
Right. So you mentioned being a college professor. I want to make sure we get to that. So you're the inaugural Alan Solomon, I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing that right, artist, scholar in residence at Tufts in the Tisch College of Civic Life. So and you said you teach a class on hip hop and social change, which I think is one of the more important classes that you can take in general, because hip hop is the soundtrack to social change, especially for the past 50 years. So tell me about what it is you're doing at Tufts and tell me about teaching this class.
I'm utilizing all my God-given gifts to make this campus a better place and a more thought-provoking place when it comes to people's relationship with hip hop. Meaning, I've done everything on campus from hosting open mics to where I know this is where I got my start as a college undergrad student at LSU in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, doing open mics on campus. And as a young brother who wanted to rap, but who had no fan base and was really just at the ground level of starting to explore my talents inside of hip hop, open mic nights, that's what really gave me my first platform to hone my skills, my performance skills, made me want to go back to the dorm room and work on my writing. So next go around, I was better. So I've hosted two open mic nights so far this school year.
Okay.
packed out. You heard me? Like, I'm talking about these things been so lit, bro. And it's been amazing to bring that energy to campus. Also, we're in Boston. So, you know, when I put a post out on Instagram, not only is the campus attending, but we just got the streets in the city of Boston that's like, well, we about to make a trip over to Tufts to go D1 hosting an open mic night. So that's been beautiful to merge the, you know, the city of Boston in with campus life at Tufts and allow all of these energies to coexist. So I've been hosting open mic nights. I am teaching my course, The Intersection of Hip Hop and Social Change, which is amazing. I'm serving as a mentor to these students on campus. Whether I teach you or not, I'm in my office, which, you know, I'm sitting in my office right now, and I make myself very available and accessible to my students and even to people that aren't my students, but just wanting them to have a person who can help them navigate what they're going through emotionally, financially, and even purpose-wise when they're in this stage of life of like, what direction do I go after graduation? How am I feeling in college? Because I went through a lot in college that could have easily made me want to drop out, could have easily just made me take the path where it was just the lowest hanging fruit and saying, okay, this will be a quick paycheck. I'll just major in engineering because they seem to all be getting good jobs coming out, knowing that that ain't my passion. You know, like I've been through all that, changing majors, all that stuff. So doing all that at Tufts and more, we're doing some stuff in my class that is pretty unprecedented too. So, you know, we are like the class is like a lab. It's like a creative lab to where you can hone your skills and your talents if you want to be an artist. But also I'm really creating a bunch of consumer activists inside the class. The type of consumers to where, yeah, you might be listening to hip hop, but you're listening to hip hop because you want to see hip hop continue to make social change. You don't just want it to turn into something it was never intended to be. So it's cool helping to build up creators and consumers.
Yeah, no, I love that. I really love the fact that so many artists now are able to be practitioners and teachers to people who are trying to understand hip hop. Like, it's not just teachers and academics who are, you know, analyzing it. You have people who are actually a part of the culture in an active way, teaching students and teaching people about. Like, I love that aspect of it. Even in my class, it's not intended to be a class about hip hop. It just ends up being always about hip hop because once the students find out that I'm a hip hop head and I'm 90s hip hop head, they get a perspective that they never had because they think the 90s was like so long ago. And I'm explaining to them how things were, the music we listen to, how it differs from what's going on. So every conversation ends up being about hip hop, even if I'm not trying to do it. But I try to do that in a very informational way, educational way, to help hone the way that I teach writing. You know, so I love that aspect of it. We're going to take one quick break here and we'll come back. I got one more question for you about your Platinum Pledge, and then we're going to do Black Fashions and the Black Medation, and we're going to get you out of here. So stay tuned with Dear Culture. All right, we're back here on Dear Culture with D1. We've been talking hip-hop culture, and you mentioned something earlier in the conversation called the Platinum Pledge. You talked about that briefly. Can you explain a little bit more about, like, how are you getting people to sign the pledge, to be more responsible in the way that they engage as a consumer with hip hop, with the art? Like, how are you going about doing that? What brought that on, and how are you going about getting people to sign that pledge?
Well, 2023 was a life-changing year for me, to where a lot of the conversations I've been having about the state of hip hop culture and the direction that it's moving in, these conversations went a lot more mainstream and were a lot more highly visible than they had ever been. But I've been having these same conversations since 2010, since my career started, like literally. So I said, okay, I don't want to just be the person who's pointing out problems in the culture and speaking about the culture from that aspect. I also want to offer solutions. So the Platinum Pledge is something that, by the grace of God, I was able to come up with. I turned Platinum into an acronym, People Leading a Transformation Involving Newly Unified Mindsets. The Platinum Pledge, it takes 3 seconds for people to sign online, and it's simply people saying, that we vow to come together to say that we don't want to create, support, or promote music that is glorifying murder, drug dealing and drug use, disrespecting women, and sexual irresponsibility. And that's what the Platinum Pledge is saying. And we want to unite. We want to show our strength in numbers for people who are like, nah, we don't want to create or push out that type of music. And that doesn't mean we're anti-hip-hop. Of course we're not anti-hip-hop. Like, we love hip-hop. We are hip-hop. But we don't want to act like that's just the status quo of something that we have to accept and have to push. So it's available at d1music.com, D-E-E, the number one, music.com. I put it out on social media at the top of the year, and instantly people started flooding the website to go it on and sign. So then I was like, ooh, D, this is really a thing, my brother. This is really a thing. There's an appetite for this. So then I brought 100 rappers together in my city, in New Orleans, you heard me? And we had a conversation called Rappers Only, to where I said, I want to have a convening of artists, just rappers, you heard me? Had 100 rappers show up, Panama, and we sat down and we had a huge roundtable discussion, to where we all talked about our mindset and our mentality that dictates and informs how we consume our art and what's our headspace when it comes to the music that we make and our goals and intentions for being in the industry. And you have people with different viewpoints, people who oppose one another, but it still showed that we're unified, you know, and we're brothers and sisters at the end of the day, and that this dialogue was needed. Just know that we thousands and thousands and thousands of people in already who have signed it, and I ain't even tap into my celebrity friends who I know gonna rock with it. I ain't even tap into the Panama Jacksons of the world yet. You heard me? So you start getting them and it's like, oh shoot, oh this person signed it, oh this person feel like that, oh they feel like that, oh da da da. So it's a movement, man, and we want everybody to be a part of it, because the goal is just simply to eradicate the glorification of what we can pretty much all agree is not healthy for our community. That's it.
We're coming to the last few segments of Dear Culture, which are some of my favorite segments, because it's where we get to have a little bit of fun, even when we're having serious conversations, which includes our Black Fashions, which is a confession about your Blackness. Do you have a Black Fashion for us?
Man, look, you only live once. So, yeah, I got a Black Fashion, man. listen, I grew up in my household, you know, for different reasons. I just didn't grow up watching a lot of movies. So in my whole life, I've probably watched like a total of maybe 30 movies. Like, I have not watched many movies at all. So therefore, you already know where I'm going with this. Oh,
what
man.
Are we doing?
Brother, I'm talking about, you could just take your pick, because any of the Black classics that you name, it's a 99% chance that D1 has not seen them things. And now in adulthood, you know, after this interview, I'm going to probably be like, all right, I got a good, you know, watch. But, bro, it's so many Black classic movies that I haven't seen that have come out during my lifetime. Ain't seen it.
Wow. So Menace to Society?
Ain't seen it.
Wow. This is a Black fashion.
Yeah, this is a Black fashion.
And it's not just the one movie you're talking about. Like, it's an entire classic. You haven't seen Love Jones?
Love Jones. That's hold on. That's I was about to say Lamar Odom. Hold on. That's
Lawrence Tate.
Yeah. I did see that one.
Okay.
I did see that one.
All right, and Neil Long. Okay.
Yeah, Neil Long. Yeah.
Five Heartbeats.
Five Heartbeats. Partially. It used to come on
WGNO. Like TNT and all them, yep.
Yeah, and all that in New Orleans, and I was just like, golly, man. I watched part of it, but I didn't see the whole thing.
That's so interesting. Okay. That is a Black fashion.
Yeah, name a couple more, because I'm gonna go watch all these, because I know, yeah.
All right. Dead Presidents?
No, I ain't see Dead President.
Love and Basketball?
I seen Love and Basketball.
Okay. So you're doing better than I thought. So you seen The Wood?
Let me see. yo, that's funny. Have I seen it? No.
It is funny. Oh, man. You seen The Color Purple?
Have you seen
it? Yeah. Okay. Every movie I'm naming, I've seen all these joints.
Oh, so you're doing a cheat code. You're going to name stuff you didn't see automatically.
All right. Because you're talking about black classic films, so I've watched all of them. Like, yeah. I'm a black movie person. I watch the movies on Tubi. Like, I'm that person.
Gotcha. I just grew up as I listened to a lot of music growing up. We didn't really get into movies in my household, so no, I ain't see The Color Purple.
Okay. All right. Well, yeah, you definitely got some homework to do then.
But I seen Baller Blocking, you heard me? I seen Hot Boys by
You seen Thuggin' and Lovin' It, parts 1 and 2?
Yeah, Thuggin' and Lovin' It. I seen New Orleans Exposed. I seen all of the stuff that then came from my city. You know, we had our ways of our ways of
Baton Rouge, like, has a ton of culture unto itself in the movie Baton Rouge, game. One of my best friends is from Baton Rouge, so I'm very familiar with the entire Baton Rouge scene. Okay, well, to offset our Black Fashions, we usually do a Black Commendation as well, which is a recommendation about something by for and about Black culture that you think people need to be up on. Do you have a Black Commendation for us?
Go to Ghana. That's what you need to get up on. Go to Ghana, because for me, going to Ghana as a young teenager growing up in New Orleans totally made me appreciate our people, our culture, our history, our smiles, our joy that much more. And that is something to where I'm going back to Africa this summer, so I'm excited about that, because I went to Ghana at a point in my childhood and my adolescence to where I could have did what we call jumping off the porch in New Orleans. You know, you get to that stage of life where you're no longer a child, you know, you're a teenager, and you can really get involved in the stuff that's going to have a detrimental effect on your life. You can really do that if you want to. But right around that time when some of my friends was, you know, metaphorically jumping off the porch, I jumped on a plane, you heard me? And I jumped on a plane and went to Ghana for this cultural exchange trip. Shout out to Miss Deborah Harley in New Orleans, who started this organization to where, you know, she took a bunch of New Orleanians and teenagers to Ghana, West Africa. And yeah, that trip totally changed my life. So I've been a brother who was always determined not to just be a product of my environment ever since I went on that trip to Ghana. I was like, oh no, I'm going to make my environment a product of me, you know, instead of me being a product of my environment. And it was because of that trip. So that's my Black commendation. Go to Africa, and I'm biased towards Ghana because that's where I went.
Fair enough. My wife is actually from Ghana, so I can stamp that message. I have been to Accra, I've been to Ghana, so I agree with that message wholeheartedly. You also have a children's book, right? You mentioned a children's book before.
I do. Now, when we talk about all the ways in which hip-hop could be used as a teaching tool in the Black community, one of them is just by making music. So my most recent album that I've put out is called From the Hood to Harvard. Right now, it's exclusively available on my website, d1music.com, D-E-E, the number one, music.com, and you can name your own price. So shout out to the thousands and thousands of people who have come and get it direct and gotten it directly from me. It will be on streaming platforms in the next couple of weeks, though, for those that's like, I'm just going to wait. All right, cool. I'm going to put it up there. But another way in which hip hop can be used as a teaching tool is through literary form. So during my fellowship at Harvard University, I also, in addition to From the Hood to Harvard album, I wrote this children's book called David Found His Slingshot. I used to get bullied when I was in kindergarten. This is a picture of me in kindergarten. It's a picture of my bully. And just like the story of David and Goliath, to where David was eventually able to defeat Goliath by using his special gift, which was his slingshot, that he was, you know, real gifted with using that slingshot. Your slingshot is a metaphor for whatever it is that's special and unique to you that you are able to do in a way that other people aren't, you know, in this world. And way back in kindergarten, metaphorically, I found my slingshot. And by finding my slingshot, it lets you know how I was able to deal with being bullied. And this this book is available, once again, exclusively on my website. The website for the book is missionvisionlifestyle.com. And this book, I'm talking about thousands of people have been blessed by this book. And it's amazing. The illustrations are amazing. The words, of course, it's a hip hop book, so it all rhymes and it reads as if you're reading like lyrics to an album, you know. So really dope, man. So if y'all got any kids that y'all care about in y'all life, this book is helping to transform how an entire generation treats one another. Absolutely. Because once you realize that you can build bridges with one another instead of just building beef with one another, it's totally different. So I recommend this book to anyone. David found his slingshot.
Awesome. Well, we appreciate your time, brother. Thank you for this conversation. I know you've been having a lot of them about the state of hip hop, and as a, like I've already said, like as a father, as somebody with children who is a hip hop head and trying to figure out how to do it, I'm always having these conversations with my friends, with the homies, with my students, just in general about the state of the culture, which is so important to me and you, and you know, me and you, your mom and your cousin too, you know, like the way that everything, I think in lyrics, right? These things are essential to who I am. So I appreciate the work that you're doing. I appreciate the thought and the intentionality in which you are bringing these conversations to light and using your tremendous platform for positive change. Please tell everybody how they can keep up with everything you got going on social media. Like, where can people find you on social media?
Yeah, so on social media, I'm D1 Music on all social media platforms. D-E-E, the number one, music. And, you know, you can check out the music on the streaming platforms, just D1, D-E-E dash the number one. Y'all tap in with me. I'm out here, man. I'm out here. I'm walking in my purpose. I'm unapologetic about it. I do love my blackness, although I ain't seen a lot of the movies that might imply that I am fully in tune with the cinematic side of our culture. But I love it, and I really love y'all for affording me this platform. Thank you for this interview, and I got much more that I'm gonna be doing, so you know, I'm sure we're gonna cross paths again and have to do some more talking about what's going on. Cause I'm not in the game to just fit in. I'm in the game to change the game, but that doesn't mean I have to make ops while doing so. It just means that I'm here to love on people, but also to challenge us to be the best version of who we are called to be.
Fair enough. Thank you to everybody for checking out this episode. Make sure you check out D1. D1's music, check out everything, the book. Make sure you check out David Found His Slingshot. And just thank you for checking out all the culture and content we have here at The Griot and here on Dear Culture. I'm Panama Jackson. Have a black one.
We started this podcast to talk about not just what Black writers write about, but how.
Well, personally, it's on my bucket list to have one of my books banned. I know that's probably bad, but
ooh.
I think...
Ooh, spicy.
They were yelling, N-word, go home. And I was looking around for the N-word because I knew it couldn't be me because I was a queen.
But I am telling people to quit this mentality of identifying ourselves by our work, to start to live our lives. And to redefine the whole concept of how we work and where we work and why we work in the first place.
My biggest strength throughout my career has been having incredible mentors, and specifically Black women.
I've been writing poetry since I was like 8. You know, I've been reading Langston Hughes and James Baldwin and Maya Angelou and so forth and so on since I was like a little kid.
Like the banjo was blackity black, right? Mm-hmm. For many, many, African. Many years. Yes. Everybody knew.
Because sometimes I'm just doing some Sam that, because I just want to do it.
An honor to be here. Thank you for doing the work that you're doing. Keep shining bright. And we and like you said, we gonna keep writing black.
As always, you can find us on the Griot app or wherever you find your podcasts.